slippery situation.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Good morning. Happy Memorial Day from American Public Media in Los Angeles. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Major crude pipelines were again targets today in Nigeria's oil region. Militants have been sabotaging the supply, and it's working. Chevron today said one incident shut down its network, and that's about 100,000 barrels per day. It's all happening as representatives from the Group of Eight Industrialized Nations are gathered talking about oil. They're gathered in Rome. Of course, the U.S. is trying to keep gas prices low so an economic recovery can take hold. Carol Ahoyas is chief financial correspondent for the Financial Times. She joins us now on the phone. Good morning.
Good morning.
So we've got the U.S. Energy Secretary, Stephen Chu, who's there, and the rest of the countries of the G8 represented. What are they working toward this week?
Well, there are two things that generally these countries are worried about. And one is energy security, and the other is clean energy. Depends which country you are. The producers are worrying that consumers will move towards alternatives and no longer take their oil. And so they don't know how much to invest in oil. And the consumers want to make sure that they have a free-flowing, reliable source of oil and gas, which fundamentally is still kind of the backbone of economic recovery.
So, Carol, Secretary Chu is pressing for less volatility in oil markets. What's he talking about as far as volatility?
Well, we've had a very volatile last half year. We were at $147 a barrel in July, and then the economic recession happened, and oil prices went all the way to $32 a barrel. When you've got so much volatility, oil companies just don't know what to do. They think, well, should we invest in the future? Are oil prices going to be low for years and years and years and we won't get a return on investment? Or should we invest now? Because, in fact, anything we put money into today, we won't see the oil for 5 or 6 years. So what happens is a kind of a paralysis.
Now, there's a big OPEC meeting this week, right? What are they going to be talking about?
Well, OPEC is critical in all of this. In terms of long-term investment, they're the ones who have the vast majority of the oil fields. In the short term, what OPEC has been doing is trying to stop the oil price from falling to a very, very low level. The U.S. hasn't been too unhappy about this because, remember, the U.S. is still the third largest producer of oil worldwide. Yes, they're a big consumer and they're the number one consumer, but there are a lot of U.S. oil companies, small U.S. producers that are hurting as well. So the U.S. stands in this weird position. On the one hand, they're actually quite happy, although they can't admit it, that the oil prices come up just a little bit. On the other hand, Chu has been very clear in saying, look, there's a limit to this. We've got to be very careful because if you overstep your bounds, it'll be bad for everybody. The economy is not going to recover. And so it'll be bad not only for the consuming nations, but it'll also be bad for the producing nations because we won't need their oil.
Carol Ahoyas, the chief energy correspondent for the Financial Times, thank you.
Thanks very much for having me.
Things quiet today on Wall Street. No trading for Memorial Day. Overall, slight gains for American markets last week. It's a bank holiday in Britain, but shares in Paris and Frankfurt are lower right now. Asian markets closed higher today. It's a contest of which company will lay off the least. Three offers are on the table for the GM European unit, Opel. 25,000 people work for the company in Germany, so that country, with its financial incentives, could have some major pull over which gets chosen. Nelson Schwartz is the European correspondent for the New York Times. He joins us on the line right now from Paris. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing well. What's happening with all these last-minute bids?
I think what you really got is the maneuvering and kind of high-stakes poker that you have in any kind of corporate deal-making, but it's more complex because you've got the governments of Germany involved as well as all these different automakers.
This is between two or three, or who's at the top and who's the runner-up here?
Basically, the two main contenders are Magna, which is an auto parts maker, mm-hmm. and Fiat, the Italian car maker. And there's a third private equity company, and then there were rumors maybe the Chinese might bid, but I think it's really down to Magna and Fiat.
So it seemed as though Fiat was the stronger of the two. What's going on there?
I think most people in the industry thought Fiat was, you know, the clear company most likely to win. The German government and union officials like Magna because it might result in fewer job cuts. There's a lot of business sense to a Fiat Opel deal, but that might mean more factory closures and job cuts, which the German government wants to avoid.
Magna, of course, being from Canada, right?
Yes, Magna's from Canada, but it also has major operations in Austria and is very familiar, you know, with all these different automakers for making parts and actually even helping make some of the vehicles. So it knows what it's doing, but it's not a traditional car company. So there's a little bit more of a risk there, I think, than with Fiat, which knows its business but needs the money from the German government to make it work.
Mm. How much are these negotiations over Opel set to determine, say, the future course for automakers?
Well, it's a really big deal because there's different visions for the auto industry out there. Sergio Marchionne is the chief executive of Fiat. He just acquired 20% of Chrysler. He wants to sort of envision a landscape where you've got a few big automakers making 5-6 million cars a year that can really achieve economies of scale. It's a compelling vision, but it's very hard to do in Europe because the governments don't want job cuts. And if you keep having all these different companies out there, you employ more people, but ultimately, you know, nobody makes that much money.
A lot of wrangling going on.
You got it.
Nelson Schwartz, European correspondent for the New York Times in Paris. Thanks.
My pleasure.
While that decision is being discussed, there's another here in this country with a deadline set for tomorrow. GM bondholders are under pressure to forgive $27 billion worth of loans. But fearing that they'll become scapegoats, many are hoping for a better payout, as Marketplace's Bob Moon reports.
The bondholders are mostly big institutions, among them pension plans and mutual fund investors, but many are mom-and-pop retail investors like Mark Modica. He's a business manager for a Saturn dealership outside Philadelphia, and he personally bought tens of thousands of dollars in GM bonds. He questions why the government and union auto workers should get control of almost 90% of GM. Bondholders are being pushed to take a bigger loss, but accept just a 10% shareholder stake.
Under bankruptcy law, creditors are supposed to get equal treatment to labor and other creditors, but what's happened here with this administration is they're just subverting the rule of law.
Modica says the government is steamrolling retirees, widows, and other small investors and setting what he calls a dangerous precedent.
What'll happen is you're never going to be able to raise capital through bond offerings again. No one's going to want to touch these things, particularly with unionized companies, since the administration is showing such favoritism to the unions.
Modica says rather than take the government's deal, he'd prefer to seek better terms in bankruptcy court and now expects to see that happen as early as this week. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Bonds are a big deal for the federal government, and this week it's set to borrow $162 billion with an auction. But recently the global appetite for U.S. debt has been on the decline. Here's Marketplace's Steve Henn.
Lately, there haven't been very many safe places for investors to stash their cash, so many bought U.S. debt at really low interest rates.
Federal government is able to borrow huge sums of money at virtually no cost, but it's like a teaser rate.
Bob Bixby directs the Concord Coalition. He says as U.S. debt mounts, the government will have to pay higher rates to attract investors. And already, there are signs of trouble. China used to lend U.S. cash for up to 30 years, but that changed when the Fed started printing money to bail out the banking industry.
Over the past several months, as a result of concerns about inflation, China's been putting almost all of its money into short-term treasury bills.
Brad Setzer's at the Council of Foreign Relations. He says economists are watching closely to see how many investors will still lend the U.S. money for the long haul and how much that new debt will cost. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
You're listening to The Morning Report on Memorial Day, Monday, May 25th, 2009, at marketplace.org. Yeah, we know some businesses have done a good bit of cutting in this recession, cutting of fees. Law firms, ad agencies, even therapists are doing it. But there seems to be another side to all this discounting. Those who are doing the discounting say their clients are getting a wee bit out of line, Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
Everyone's negotiating fees these days, but Mark Brownstein of marketing agency The Brownstein Group says negotiating is one thing, demanding is another. He recently heard from a lawyer friend.
He said that clients have been dictating fees to them. So if a lawyer has a certain billable hour, the client is saying, no, this is what we're going to pay for the service.
He says marketing firms have also experienced a sudden rash of what he calls bad behavior from clients. Emails have a cranky tone. Some clients don't pay invoices until they're chased. Some even want firms to break ethical boundaries. Brownstein says one client wanted his agency to fudge some numbers.
It seems that this recession, the longer it goes, is unveiling the dark side of perfectly civilized and likable professionals.
Brownstein says his company refused, of course. He understands companies are under enormous pressure to conserve cash, but he says being antagonistic or pushy can gnaw away at relationships that took a lot of time, effort and money to build. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Having a baby can be tough enough for the people of a region prone to financial restraints and violence. But what about the Lebanese couples who, without help, cannot have children? Now a bank, of all places, is helping out with loans. Ben Gilbert reports from Beirut.
When Maher Mezhir first heard that his fellow Lebanese were more infertile than the average person, the marketing professor started doing his homework on married couples.
We have done a quantitative research on 600 persons showing that 18.7% couldn't have babies.
Mezhir, who's also a marketing manager at Lebanon's First National Bank, saw dollar signs. He calculated that each year, around 10,000 couples in Lebanon undergo fertility treatments of some kind. Mezhir's research resulted in this. This is the First National Bank's ad for a fertility loan. It's part of an ad blitz that features a very small, cute newborn baby curled up and sleeping on a blanket. The kid is on billboards and in magazines. Lebanese sociologists have noted the pressure society exerts on newlyweds to have children here. Mezhir says Lebanese families can be overbearing.
If after 3 or 5 or 6 months they don't see that the lady is pregnant, they start asking, is it she or you? Are you trying? When are you trying?
And adoption is not an option for most Lebanese. It's banned for Muslims, and Christians frown on it. Infertility is also grounds for divorce here. But now Mezhir says his loan can help. Couples can borrow $7,000 at 5% interest. It can be used to finance in vitro fertilization surgery or fertility treatments. Mezhir says the bank isn't looking to profit off the loans. He says they are humanitarian and good marketing for FNB Bank.
Because this is the best way to touch their heart. Each time they would look at their baby and the baby would smile, they would remember FNB. It is the best way to get into their life.
Some Lebanese have objected to Mezhir's fertility loan. But Mezhir says in the ad campaign's first week, his bank received more than 100 calls a day. In Beirut, I'm Ben Gilbert for Marketplace.
Years ago, we started to see the beginnings of the Bear Stearns mortgage-backed securities debacle. Of course, it wasn't until 2008 that the company fell. But the path started months and months before that. Fortune magazine's Alan Sloan remembers. He joins us now. Alan, since it's such a dubious occasion, why not just forget about it?
Because the meltdown is still going on, and there are things that we need to learn. And the best way to learn is to have some artificial event, which I've created, which is the meltdown anniversary, on which to step back and look at things.
And the clues, all these clues that were out there, people just didn't pick up on?
Well, there were clues to the pieces. Okay, you could see that house prices in the United States were crazy. You could see that the prices being paid in leveraged buyouts were crazy. You could see that all over the world, there was much more credit than logic would suggest there should be, and it was priced very cheap. What people didn't realize is that having the subprime mortgages start to collapse was like throwing a match in a forest where it hadn't rained for years, and suddenly you saw the whole forest in flames. That's the thing we missed, that the whole world financial system was going to go up in flames when the junk mortgages began to fail.
So we go from Bear Stearns to the collapse of Lehman Brothers. What are the consequences of that collapse in September of last year?
All right. One is we almost lost the world financial system because of things that had not been predicted when Lehman went down. And as a result of that, regulators are so spooked that closing, say, Citi, which I'm not saying should be closed, or some of these other giant institutions would be a Lehman II, that there's just no way they're going to do it. And that's why the world's regulators are being so nice now to the giant financial institutions because no one wants to risk a second Lehman, which is another lesson, really, of the anniversary. And you step back and look at it, you can see that that's what's going on still.
So does this mean we've all learned a lesson and it'll never happen again?
Well, people say this will never happen again and life will be good and everyone goes and sings Kumbaya. That happens on television. It doesn't even happen on radio, at least not public radio. And it has never happened in public life.
And it hasn't happened here. Fortune Magazine's Alan Sloan joining us. Alan, thank you.
You're welcome, Steve.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for being with us. Have a nice holiday.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.